Welcome to The Deep End by On Deck, a podcast for visionary builders, creators, and thinkers discuss world-changing stories and ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozloff.
So there are meditation apps, there are beverages, there are sneakers, there are psychology sessions, there are everything that you can think of to target health and wellness. News is actually one of the biggest drivers of depression in the world. And nobody has sat back and said, well, why don't we just fix the news? Why don't we just create an alternative that makes people feel happier and healthier and more positive about the world and uses the news to treat anxiety and depression?
On Deck is where ambitious people worldwide go to start companies, find their next roles, and invest in their careers. The Deep End invites the founders, operators, and investors from the On Deck community and beyond to turn their experiences into the ideas others need to start their own odysseys. Joining me this week in The Deep End is Mohammed Lila, the founder of Goodable and previously a war zone correspondent leading global news coverage at CNN and ABC, where he was nominated for 2 Emmy Awards. Today's discussion is around Mohammed's vision for fixing news by changing it from one of the biggest drivers of anxiety and depression into a cure. This discussion includes topics such as how why more than 90% of news coverage is negative, what this does to our mental health, and how the current news environment would be the equivalent to our physical health of living in a town where McDonald's is the only restaurant option. Goodable's mission is to change this by offering the first Whole Foods alternative to the current fast food dominated news ecosystem. It's a news platform designed to make you calmer and healthier by avoiding bias, politics, and negativity. Mohammed has a fascinating, ambitious underlying vision for this that we dig into in our conversation. We also discuss some powerful ideas about the news media's place in our society and mental health. So without further ado, let's dive in. Mohammed Lila, welcome to The Deep End.
Happy to be here, Marshall. Love what you're doing and excited to be a guest.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you. We were chatting a bit before we started this episode. I come from the news business, so this is a perfect intersection of the tech investment focus and my actual true love slash actual background here. So let's just get started. I love when a startup makes an argument, and your argument is that news is broken. Now, you're taking it from a slightly different perspective. So this isn't an argument about advertising is broken or subscriptions are the answer. Like, what is your specific answer to why the news industry is broken?
First of all, thanks for having me on. And that's a brilliant question because our argument is actually a lot more fundamental than what you see. So everybody looks at the news and they say the revenue model is broken, the distribution model is broken, the hiring models are broken, diversity has been a big issue in news and journalism for like forever. We take a very basic fundamental approach, and the approach is this. For decades, the news has been making us miserable. It's been feeding us content that makes us have trouble sleeping at night. It creates anxiety and it creates depression, and it's doing it on a global scale. And so if you look at the whole idea of making people healthy and making people feel well, it's a massive space. It's a massive TAM, to use investor terminology. And everybody has tried entering that space through almost everything you can imagine. So there are meditation apps, there are beverages, there are sneakers, there are psychology sessions, there are everything that you can think of to target health and wellness. News is actually one of the biggest drivers of depression in the world. And nobody has sat back and said, well, why don't we just fix the news? Why don't we just create an alternative that makes people feel happier and healthier and more positive about the world and uses the news to treat anxiety and depression? So to us, what we're doing is that's the easiest argument to make in the world, right? If you have a phone, it means you're getting exposed to negativity on a daily basis, whether you want to or not. So if you have Apple News or Google News or whatever, 90% of what you're getting is negative, probably even 95% today. And so we sat back and we said, well, if everything that you're getting is negative, why don't we just give people an alternative and see what happens? So that's the argument that we're making. And it's been a very interesting experiment because in the beginning, it was just me just posting stuff online and seeing if it stuck. And the growth has been mind-blowingly amazing for us. It's been a huge surprise for us that it would happen so quickly. And the argument is that news has massive untapped potential to be used as a tool for health and wellness. And that's what we're out here proving every single day.
And you're the perfect person to speak on this topic with, because as we were discussing before, you were a war correspondent. So you're not just some random person who sat in a basement saying, whoa, you know, the news is not vibey and why can't everything, you've actually dealt with, especially given the context of what's happening in Ukraine right now, I think you are deeply aware at a very visceral level of the fact that there are important things going on in the world and that news, journalism, et cetera, serves an important function. So I'll just ask the pointed question. How does one maintain positivity in news without becoming vapid, right? Without just saying, oh man, Ukraine's a bummer. Here's a listicle. I know that's not what you're doing, but I think this is what the skeptical side of people's personalities, because I think, frankly, let's be real, news startups made arguments adjacent to that before.
That's a great question. And I'll answer it with an analogy and then I'll get very specific. So the way the news works right now, the way the industry has been built, it's as though you and I, Marshall, right now, we live in a town or a city where the only thing to eat is McDonald's. So when you want to go out, you see the golden arches everywhere you go. They're on every billboard. They're on every road sign. Eat at McDonald's. When you want to go out, you're taking your spouse, your significant other, you're the kids or the kids, and you ask them, hey, where do you guys want to go out today? And everybody says, McDonald's, McDonald's. McDonald's has made us believe that they're the only game in town. Now, here's a question. What happens in that town if you're the first person to open up a Whole Foods? And let's take it a step further. What if you open up a Whole Foods and you can make it the same price, the same convenience, and the same distance as McDonald's? Now suddenly you have a choice. You can go to a place that gives you food that's not good for you, or you can go to a place that's the same price that gives you food that is good and healthy and wholesome for you. Which one would people choose? Let me throw that out to you, Marshall. Which one would you choose?
Yeah, let's stick with the metaphor, but I want to ask you a basic question that picks apart the town metaphor, right? So a town, right? Like a town has everyone living in it. And when you were describing how the news makes you feel bad, I instantly thought about the doom scrolling I would do every morning, especially towards the start of the invasion of Ukraine. I would wake up, I would literally spend 50 minutes just scrolling through Twitter. After the first 5 minutes, value add was happening. I was learning about this. Oh, this town was taken. This town wasn't taken. This assassination attempt on Zelensky failed. But after those first 5 minutes, it was just doom scrolling. How common is the experience that we're describing here? Because it's not that I'm nitpicking with your example. I'm just curious. So like everyone eats, but how many people doom scroll and how many people are using Apple News and Twitter the way that people who listen to, say, to this podcast do?
Yeah, so the statistics and the hard data show that 90% of everything that we consume in the news is negative. And the running joke is that the other 10% is the weather. But 90% is statistically documented, that it's driven by fear or negativity. And it's not that surprising when you think about it. Forget about Ukraine. I mean, try reading US politics. That's the most negative rabbit hole that you're going to go down to, right? Because the moment one person does something good, half of America hates it. And the moment somebody who's quote unquote bad, and I use that in quotation marks, does something good, the rest of America hates it. It's designed to be divisive. And the biggest proof of that is if you look at the recent elections, like they've all been razor close. It's designed to split people almost down the middle. And so when you look at the news that you consume, it's not a hard argument to accept that it makes you negative. It does. And we're not even talking about social media yet, right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about the effect of the posts that you see on Instagram and Facebook. I'm talking about strictly news. And if you look at the news, that is the reality, that we live in a town where all there is to eat or consume is negative news. And what's interesting about this is, at least on a global scale, nobody has tried to build a Whole Foods. And one of the reasons why that's so difficult is because McDonald's is so damn powerful. All these news networks out there are so damn powerful, and they've made us believe that they're performing a service for us in a bizarre kind of way by making us anxious, depressed, miserable, afraid, angry, you name it. And so when Whole Foods came out, I bet you a bunch of people attacked them too, right? A bunch of people were like, oh, Whole Foods, you're spending five times as much to eat broccoli that you could get somewhere else. And in the beginning, people ignored us. And then they started kind of attacking us and criticizing us. And ironically, you know, because you have a lot of investors here, like the same people that thought this would never happen are now cold calling me as investors and saying, hey, like, tell me about the state of your next round. We want to get ahead of it. And I think it shows that what we're proving is that news can be a tool for mental health. And we're proving it out here every day with what we're doing. And it's working so far.
So the key thing, and this is why the Whole Foods metaphor is a perk, because this is the key thing I want to understand, the unique value add that you're providing here. It's not just that you're saying, hey, we're going to produce stories that aren't negative or aren't aggressive, because once again, that's something that's been done before. The key take here that you're making is that news consumption is a key part of mental health and the way that we go about the world. Therefore, you're actually building a product and a company that's actually structured around using news and information to just do it. Is that a good summary? Just to understand because I'm trying to get at what differentiates between this and, let's say, once again, the listicle 2014 through 2016 era.
Yeah. So that's a great question. And I'll even take it a step further. Look, if you want to find videos and images that make you feel happy, you can find them online. We all have shared or watched the cute video of the dog on a skateboard, right? Or the dog that like helps police find their owner that has collapsed in the forest, right? Those things are out there. And so if you look at the quote unquote good news networks today, there's actually one called Good News Network, Good News Movement. There's a bunch of other ones, right? Upworthy was probably the biggest one. Ashton Kutcher invested in something called A+K. And it was very interesting because they were based on an old revenue model and they were based on an old line of thinking, which was, hey, let's just put out content that people love, we'll go viral, and then we'll sell some advertising and we'll make money. And so the revenue model was basically locked into what's your CPM, what's your cost per click, you know, how much will investor,
could you explain that? Once again, I'm a news nerd, but can you explain what those metrics mean, like CPMs?
Yeah, sure. So CPM just stands for like cost per mil or like cost per thousand. And what it basically means is that advertisers will pay you a certain amount of money for every 1,000 impressions that you create. And usually that number is like between $4 and $10, depending on sort of the audience that you have. And so the challenge with that is that in a down year, like for example, with COVID, those advertising rates go down. And if your advertising rates go down, you make less money. And so Upworthy exploded in the beginning, and then they had to lay off something like 80% of their staff once ad rates went down. It's the same problem that CNN, Fox News, BBC, CBC here in Canada, everybody struggles with that. Because when it's a good advertising market, they do well. And when it's a bad advertising market, they have to lay people off. And that's why you see that in the media industry, things are always cyclical, mm-hmm. right? So you go through a period where like everybody's hiring. Like there's a point where like New York Times is like hiring everybody. And then they slowed down and it's like, what happened? And then they were laying people off. Vice went from like a valuation that was like almost zero to something like 4 billion yeah. in like 4 or 5 years. And now they're back down to like whatever it is, 400, 500 million, something like that. BuzzFeed did the same thing. And the problem was that they based their revenue almost entirely on advertising. We sat back and we said, well, everybody's missing the point here. Because they're just looking at eyeballs. They're like, hey, let's just get people to watch our content. We took it a step further and we said, look, we know that exposure to positive sounds and images is a critical part of a psychologist's therapy to help pull people out of anxiety and depression. And so when we started speaking with therapists, you know, the biggest issue was they would say, hey, listen, we spend an hour, 2 hours with our patients. They come in and we work with them really hard to remove negative influences from their life. And the moment they leave our office, they're back on their phones and they're drowning in negativity again. And so we said, well, what if we could fix that? What if we could do it so that we gave them a program, a regimen, a routine that took them away from that negativity and used news to improve their mental health? So your question was spot on because that's exactly what we're doing. We've designed actually in our app, which just launched, like one of our modules is specifically designed to treat stress, anxiety, and depression, and it's been approved by a psychologist. So this is actually groundbreaking because imagine in the old school days, I don't know if I'm timing myself here, but I grew up reading a newspaper, right? I had a physical newspaper that I would read. Now imagine if that newspaper, every single article was approved by a psychologist. And they read it and they said, you know what? Yes, I vouch as a psychologist that I would prescribe this newspaper to people that are suffering from mental health conditions. That's exactly what we're doing. And no one's ever done it before.
You know, I want to spend lots of time on definitions here because this is an interesting space where you're having to spend a lot of time on that. Define negative news.
Yeah, it's a really good question because it's also, you know, important to define the opposite, which is positive news, mm-hmm. right? You got to see them in contrast, right? One of the things that we found at Goodable was positive to me is different to you, is different to somebody else, right? So U.S. politics is the greatest example of that. For some people, Joe Biden announces he's going to tax billionaires, right? So for a lot of people, they're like, that's the greatest thing in the world, unless you're a billionaire, in which case probably the worst thing in the world, right? So positivity and negativity, a lot of times are in the eye of the beholder. And so what we did was we've actually built out machine learning that scans through this for us. But if you look at the fringes, right? So if you look at on the far right and the far left, there's an area that's really contentious. So politics, abortion, certain other topics, almost anywhere in the world, they're really contentious. So we stay away from them. And what we found was that in the middle, in that sort of 80% in the middle, there's a broad consensus on what constitutes positive and negative. So for example, if I showed you a video of a woman getting arrested because she assaulted her children, nobody in their right mind would say that's positive. Almost every single person would say that's negative. And that's instinctive. We don't need to be told that. We don't need to be taught that. We just know it. Now, the flip side is also true. A woman who dives into a frozen lake to save a child that was drowning is an incredibly positive story. And that's the space that we operate in. And it's working. So I'll give you an anecdote, which is kind of crazy. In the early days of launching Goodable, right when we were really exploding on social media, we posted a story of, it was a teacher, I think in Mexico or New Mexico, or I don't remember the exact location. I think it was there. And she was a teacher where the schools had been closed because of COVID. So she got in a pickup truck, she got a whiteboard and she put in the pickup truck and she drove around to the kids' homes and she taught math out of the back of her pickup truck, right? There's a great story. People on the left started retweeting it like crazy, like MSNBC anchors and CBC anchors. And like, that's normal for us. We're used to that. The next morning I wake up and Ivanka Trump had retweeted it. And I didn't know how to feel about that, right? Because they're, you know, as much as they're in politics, there's also a lot of mixed opinions about the Trump family, right?
Yeah.
And so she retweeted it. And then we had all these people from the right retweeting it. And we did an analysis and we looked at what they were saying. And actually both sides were saying the same thing. Both sides were saying, what an incredible woman, what an incredible story. And so I think there's an area there that our instinct is to say when it comes to news, oh, this is biased, this is slanted. But there's an area there that nobody has really kind of been exposed to on a regular basis where it's understood, like, this isn't political, this isn't editorial, it's just good news. And that's where we exist.
Something I want to understand a little more, and I got at this with the doom scrolling question, is at the start when you're describing there are all these apps, there are even sneakers, you're describing a set of customers who are very well aware of the importance of mental health. They're like hyper aware of these different things. They're focusing on meditation. Who is this psychographic? And then why? Because it seems to be insinuating that the status quo isn't working for them. This app is feeling, just help us understand like the real category you're talking about here.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So on the broadest level, on sort of like the bottom level of the pyramid, if you will, it's anybody who consumes news. And so our core product is free and it will always remain free because if I had a magic button and I could press it and make somebody happy, I'm going to do it and I'm not going to charge somebody for it. So that's the basic.
And level. That's the app, or is that but your social that, media? Just to understand like what's free here.
I mean, it's both. And we're also launching an actual channel, mm-hmm. like an actual Goodable TV channel very soon, which
cool.
This might be the first time I've ever mentioned that in public to anybody. So you're breaking that news, but, that's coming up very soon. And so those products that we're releasing are free. We're not going to charge people for it. But on the higher level, there's a consumer subscription, which is people who want to be part of our community, and it's growing and it's thriving. There's a healthcare subscription, which is people who suffer from anxiety, mental health, depression, you name it, which is a monthly subscription. And we believe that we can actually treat and one day cure depression and anxiety through the news. That's how confident we are. But there's also an enterprise subscription, which is a way for large-scale businesses to provide a news stream to their employees that improves their productivity. And this is a big issue because mental health costs American companies around $51 billion a year. People call in sick, they have low productivity, they make fun of the boss when they're around other employees, like just that whole negative spiral that we're exposed to. So there's a customer base there as well, which is like, look, we'll make your employees feel better about themselves, better about the world, and better about your company. So there are different tiers of consumers, and it's very difficult to pencil it in to say, okay, you know, our demographic is like 25-year-old single women who are, you know, also going to yoga classes. Like, that's not the case. To go back to the analogy, our customers are people who would prefer to go to Whole Foods than McDonald's.
Yeah. And we've done a couple episodes on the deep end around mental health. And I remember before the pandemic, I was in New York City working, ironically enough, for PBS. So I was in the news space then. And I remember seeing the like Michael Phelps mental health ads. And this is like 2018, 2019. So this is really when the conversation around mental health is starting to really pop open. People are much more comfortable discussing it. A lot of the business model things you're discussing are becoming a thing, this, this, and that. Today, we're 2+ years into the COVID era. I would love for you, especially because given when you launched, you to track where the audience you're focused, track how the audience you're focusing on, how their mental health and how the products, the features, the things they've been thinking about have just shifted over the past 2.5 years or so.
Yeah, you know, and that's very important. And we're very mindful of keeping an eye on our data and our early users. But one of the things that happened in the news space happened a little bit earlier than that. It happened when President Trump was elected, even into the primaries and into the election. Every single network doubled down on the negativity, right? They had a golden window, actually, if they wanted to launch something in 2016, but they couldn't because their journalism instincts were telling them that, hey, this person, this character in President Trump, we don't know why, but people can't get enough of him. And that doesn't mean that he was good or bad. It just meant that, and I know this because I was at CNN when this was happening. Anytime you wrote about or you included President Trump in your story, the traffic would just spike. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't figure out at the time, right? Because it wasn't happening for, you know, Mitt Romney. It wasn't happening for Ted Cruz. It wasn't happening for any other candidate. It wasn't even happening for Hillary or Obama. It was just Trump. And everybody saw this gold mine and they said, you know what? Let's just go Trump all the time. And so they doubled down on the negative discourse that was taking place. And that was their revenue model. So it made sense for them, right? Hey, let's just get eyeballs and let's make money. So the best thing that has happened, or one of the silver linings that's happened as a result of the pandemic, is that as the news world continues to get worse and worse, we wind up becoming more popular and goodable without having to do any work for it. Like so, for example, our reach is 100% organic. When I left CNN, I was averaging a reach of around 200,000 impressions per month, which is kind of low for CNN. Within a year, we were at 4 million. We're now at 40 million. So we reach an audience of 40 million people per month without having spent a single cent on any advertising or marketing.
Via social, correct?
Totally via social.
And then a quick thing to help the audience understand why what you're saying is so important. If you're looking at a lot of these 2015, 2016 era media companies, so much of their reach was hyper platform dependent. And it was like advertising, marketing, spending. So much of the VC you would raise would go into pushing out your content, which was actually a huge problem because there wasn't people actually building deep relationships with their audiences. This was just pouring money into a funnel and hoping it would convert.
And so I'll give you an example. So I go into like investor meetings, right? And we closed a huge round and, you know, I'm now having meetings on the next round. And so I go into investor meetings and they're like, okay, so what's your cost for user acquisition? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And they go, well, you know, what numbers have you crunched to show like how much it costs you to get a user? I'm like, it doesn't cost us anything. And they don't understand. They're like, how is that possible? I'm like, well, we reach 40 million people a month on social media. We have the world's top athletes, influencers, astronauts share our content all the time. And all I need to do is slide into like Pharrell Williams' DMs or John Cena's DMs, or we just had a couple of like astronauts retweet us and say, hey, you love what we do. Do you want to just tell people to like get on our app and our platform? And they do. And investors don't understand the power of organic reach because they're not used to it, right? So usually startups will raise a round and like 40% of the round right off the bat goes into marketing, right? And it goes into like Facebook ads or Google ads or whatever, right? And it's like, well, what happens if you didn't have to spend that money and you could just focus that money on your product? That's the situation, the lucky situation that we find ourselves in.
Do you create your own content or do you curate other people's content?
We do both. So we've built a very advanced machine learning model that scans thousands of articles every day. We'll have the capacity to actually scan 1,000 news sources. So New York Times is one source, right? Mm-hmm. Washington Post is one source. We'll have the ability to scan thousands of news sources every hour if we want to. And the machine learning tells us, is this story positive or negative? Is it happy or is it sad? The accuracy that we found is already at around 90%, which is really high. So we take that and it's a curation model where we find good news as soon as it's reported anywhere in the world. We optimize it for certain outcomes, for example, like helping you sleep better, helping you feel better, helping you perform better. And then we deliver it to your fingertips, whether that's the app or whether that's our TV channel or whether that's social media, you name it. So there's, I would say 80% of it is curated. The other 20% is content that we create ourselves. And that's old school journalism, man. That's the stuff that I love, right? Which is just writing, creating videos. Google actually found out what we were doing. They wanted to participate in the round and they basically wound up paying us to put content on YouTube, which is a very different model. Because normally you got to go on YouTube and like have thousands of views and whatever and make a little bit of money. YouTube was like, no, we want to pay you now. We're just going to keep paying you. Just we want you to be on our platform and don't go to like TikTok or one of these other guys.
So when you talked about TV, you created, is your TV plan about creating a YouTube channel and content there? Or are you like thinking like a streaming service? Like how are you thinking about that?
So we are, one of our investors is one of the biggest names in Hollywood, probably the most connected person in Hollywood. And he loves what we're doing. And he, so I have to be careful because he's asked for privacy and I want to respect that. But he has connections with every over-the-top provider that you can think of. So Hulu, Netflix, Roku, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, all those things. We're exploring a couple of things. One is a weekly show that'll eventually become a daily show, which is like the world's first newscast that only covers good news. But we're also launching a channel. And I can't give too many details away, but it would be a 24-hour stream that you would be able to see in office places, stadiums, restaurants, hospitals, bars, you name it, eventually tens of thousands of locations across America, maybe even by the end of this year, where you'll see Goodable Live, which is really exciting for us.
So this brings up the question of, I'd love for you to talk about an obvious thing that people are probably thinking about, which is remember when John Krasinski had his, what was that show again? This was during the start of COVID.
Some Good News.
Yeah, Some Good News. And as I understand it, the story is actually more complicated than was initially reported. So maybe he didn't sell it to, I don't quite know what, but basically like what lessons did you, so if you could just tell that story from your perspective for listeners who don't remember this, because it feels like ancient history, but just how you think about the lessons from how well his content, how his idea went and what that means for things going forward.
Yeah. So the basic gist of it for your listeners and your viewers is John Krasinski is an actor who at the beginning of the pandemic, I guess, was stuck at home like the rest of us. And he started a once a week thing called Some Good News. And he broadcast it from, I guess, his den or his library or whatever. And it was pretty low quality, but he's a comedian. He's funny and it took off.
This is Jim from The Office, everyone, in case, or Captain, not Captain America, but yeah, Jim from The Office.
Yeah. And I guess he's been in some other stuff too. So, you know, he produced the show. It was like 8 minutes or 10 minutes per episode. And I think he did 5 or 6 episodes before taking a break and then selling it. I believe it was to CBS Viacom. So the numbers were never released in terms of how much he sold it, but it wound up doing a couple of things. Number one, his fans hated it because he had just started building this thing and then he sold it to the corporate America, right?
So they hated when he sold it. They liked the product. They didn't like that he sold it is the key.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Because, you know, it made him look like he was kind of selling out. Like he built this thing and he just sold it for some money and then he kind of let it go, right? So that was the first thing that happened. It was he really alienated his consumers, his fan base. The second thing it did was there were actually 9 different networks that were bidding on his show, which is really interesting. None of this was publicized, but I you know, there are a lot of insiders in the industry with my background that I know. And so I asked one of them, I'm like, what was the going price for how much he sold it for? So the talk was that, you know, he sold it for like 20, 25 million, something like that. And there's two interesting takeaways from that, lessons that we learned. Number one was that he took 5 episodes and he sold them for 20 to 25 million bucks. If you do the math, that's a great investment because those episodes probably cost him almost nothing to make. But number two, it shows that one network out of the 9 successfully bid on that and won the bid. That means there are 8 other networks out there, Amazon Prime, Hulu, Apple, whatever, that are looking for a product that doesn't exist yet because nobody has taken the time to build it. And so our thinking was, you know, I had an investor who came to me and he said, look, what if somebody offers you 20 to 25 million to buy what you're doing? And my answer was, well, if they're willing to offer me 20 to 25 million, I should be able to at least raise 20 to 25 million and sell this when it's a $1 billion company. And that's what I learned from John Krasinski. Never sell out, never give up on your fans. And when you're onto something, ride it as far as you can until the end.
And the key thing, and I want people to really understand this, and this is why this is generally a really cool business. That was one show that was worth 20 to 25 million. So ideally, if things keep working out for you, you could build this brand, Goodable, that maybe has a show and maybe you co-produce this show with a Hollywood actor or a creator or someone does well on TikTok. And if you could create a bunch of this type of show with this type of editorial brand, like that's an incredibly successful media business.
I mean, look at it the other way, right? So, we have different revenue streams, right? So subscription revenue is a big deal for us, right? It's the same model as Headspace and Calm is the app. We even go so far as to say, hey, we're Headspace for news, or we're Calm for news, which doesn't exist. So the subscription revenue is important because it's driven by tech and it's scalable, and it's scalable without extra cost for us. I don't have to hire a team of 100 people. I can do everything that we're doing with a team of 3 or 4 people, right? Which is insane when you think about it. So the tech revenue is really important for us. Now, most tech companies have an issue because they build a good product and they sit around saying, well, okay, how do we get people to start using it? Mm-hmm. Right. And that goes into the marketing. We did it the opposite way. We built our audience first, right? We built this really strong, loyal, powerful audience of influencers and celebrities. And now when we launch an app, they love it. So we're averaging 1 download a minute, right? From, I think we're up to like 80 different countries now and no advertising budget, none of that. It's all just word of mouth. And so pull back from that and look at what happens if you build a startup with community first. Build a community, build the product. The app is the product, social media is the product, but we've also got this 24-hour channel that we're launching that's going to be part of the product as well. And all of that works as this kind of massive flywheel that all works together to drive revenue in multiple places. So BuzzFeed and Vice were stuck because it's like we're going to produce expensive content and we've got to make our money back through advertising. We're like, you know, we're curation, a really small team. We've automated our TV channel. All of that is designed to get people to feel better about themselves. And some of those people will take it a step further and pay us a lot of money to cure their problems.
And this is what I'll say in defense of BuzzFeed, Vice, the digital media 2015 companies, which is part of the reason why people start focusing on original content is brand differentiation. Let's hire these unique reporters. Let's put out this big project, X, Y, and Z thing. If I think of the mental health space, a problem that I would diagnose as just an interested outsider is hardcore commodification. I don't honestly know a difference between Better. I don't know a difference between Calm. I've got the Equinox app. They have a meditation thing. I don't know how any of these things are actually different from one another. So how do you maintain your unique value proposition in a space where, once again, like given what you're describing, I'm not saying they could pull it off the way you could pull it off, but like someone else could say, hey, like I'm going to create a good news machine learning app too. Like how do you remain unique when most of what you're doing, at least right now, is that curation feature?
Yeah, it's really important. Part of that is the voice that we've built. It's reassuring. It's comforting. People know what they're getting when they're coming to us. And so, for example, like, you know, our biggest investor, who's this big name in Hollywood, when he was talking to me initially about the idea, he goes, you know, what would make you different from watching CNN or consuming content from some other platform. And we said, okay, well, CNN is angry and divisive and sensational, and we're like the exact opposite. And he said, make sure that anything you do reflects that tone and voice, because people will come to you for consistency when they know what they're getting, and they're getting a specific worldview when they come to you, and ours is positive. The second part of that question is really interesting. Like, you know, the story of Peloton is something that drives me, right? So the Peloton founders had a difficult time raising. They raised a really small round in the beginning. Nobody believed that you could take a exercise bike, throw kind of an iPad type thing on it, and people would pay $2,000 or $3,000, right, to buy that. The big turning point for them happened when they built the product, and one of the founders went to a fitness club in LA. It was like a cycling club. And they looked at the sign-up sheet for the cycling classes. And Tuesday nights, I think it was always full. The dude that was running that cycling class was so powerful that there weren't enough spaces in his class. And like Wednesday and Thursday were empty. For some reason, people just loved this trainer. And so they went to him and they said, hey, listen, like you can only have 20 or 30 people in your class and you're so full. What if you could have 200 people in your class and make even more money and not have to turn people away? And he's like, yeah, man, sign me up. Where do I sign up? And so they Peloton took off because people in that neighborhood or in LA knew that trainer. And word spread that suddenly, hey, this trainer is doing stuff online. Let's get him. So we've got a couple of tricks up our sleeve to work with some really big names that are going to surprise people, where they can leverage their own audiences and followers to be part of doing something good in the world. So there's an influencer model that we're building into Goodable that you're going to see it. You'll see it, I think, in the next maybe 2 months, we're going to release it. And it's going to be a game changer in the industry.
See, and this is another cool thing that you're doing here, which is I was pushing you on the what differentiates you question, but it seems like the unique thing that you've done here is understand that there's a real like ideological or vision based thing here. So when someone, so let's say like when you, you know, slide into someone's DMs and, you know, get a retweet or something, they're not just doing that because they like the video, but they're doing it because they actually buy into the vision of the company.
100%.
And they actually want to push out to someone, hey, but this isn't just like me saying, here's a cat video. This is me saying like, hey, like, I want you to be healthy. I want you to like not feel doom scrolling. And I think that's just so important because it also goes to something that you've corrected upon from previous eras of this type of news where it's like, hey, CNN's broken. People have heard that pitch before, but so much of the pitch was much more technical and kind of insidery, right? So in the sense of like, no one has a cable news subscription anymore. So like we're bringing news to the Facebook generation. That's true. Like that's actually a real thing. But me retweeting that, me pushing that out doesn't have actually the same like ideological valence or deep meaning than what you're describing. And I think that's just so key. And I don't think it's genuinely exciting.
Yeah. And so here's how we look at it, right? It's like, people consume content from all different types of places. First of all, I should say we see ourselves as a health and wellness company, not a content company. We're just using news in a way that's never been used before, but we see ourselves as health and wellness. And the proof of that is that both Apple and Google admitted us into their app stores as the first ever news apps in the health and wellness category. And it was a huge win for us because it shows that Apple and Google now accept that news can be a tool for mental health and wellness. So that was a big win for us. It happened just like last week or the week before. But more importantly, we have an advantage where people say, I watch CNN or I use Calm or I use Headspace. Nobody says, I want to be CNN. I want to be Fox. We get people messaging us every day saying, I want to be Goodable. How can I be Goodable? And that's the difference. People want to be part of us. And we've built a community and tools and a product that allows them to be part of us. So if I say, hey, Marshall, like, do you watch Goodable? You might be like, yes or no. I'd be like, hey, Marshall, man, can I help you be Goodable? It's a totally different equation. And that's the difference, right? It's like, we're not just a product, right? We're something else. We're like a movement. We're an organic grassroots feeling that we give people. We're a label that people can attach to themselves. And that's what makes us different.
So once again, like the key, because I just want to keep like hitting the themes here. Like the key theme here is that content for you is not the primary thing. So the pitch is not saying, hey, investors, all the kids are on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok these days. We're going to create content that they like. And by them liking it, they're going to share it and put it out. And you make money because we sell ads on that. That is not the pitch here. And that's why you're saying that content isn't actually the central thing. It's the health and wellness aspect. You know, I rarely ever get to get newsy on the deep end. So I want to do it. CNN Plus is coming out this week.
Yeah,
like totally. Really good timing. So I would love for you to just, I don't need you to like hate or just like critique, but we are just kind of at an interesting era for the news industry. And you've worked in this industry yourself too. So CNN Plus, for those who don't know, is, you know, CNN like recognizing that once again, if you're like younger, you most likely don't subscribe to cable. There is a need for news in the world. So they're creating this subscription product. Just what is your thought about the state of this in-between news industry?
Yeah, it's really good because I think that state of being in between is only going to last for another year or so.
So
CNN is coming out with CNN Plus. I'm surprised it took them this long. I know a little bit of insider information on why it took them so long, which is what I understand. But I think CNN Plus will eventually be CNN. I think that's just the reality, that the programming that you're seeing on CNN Plus will eventually take over what you see on traditional cable television, and that's just the way it's going to evolve. Every other network is doing the same thing. CBS News, I think a couple of years ago, announced that I forgot what their platform is called, but CBSN. They announced all these deals with local affiliates to get them more content. And so now they can go live, I think, in like 40 markets or 50 markets in America. ABC has the same thing with ABC News Live. I'm friends with some of their anchors because I used to work there. Like, I know that, digital or over the top used to be like looked down upon at these networks. Like, oh, I have to file for digital. I got to do a live for digital. They're giving me a little cutesy little show on digital. Nobody really took that seriously. But the reality of the market is that that's the future. And every network, every news network out there is already preparing for it. And it makes sense. Like, people just don't watch TV anymore. Most people consume news on their phones. Most people will consume news while they're watching other things. So like you're watching, I don't know, Sopranos, or you're going back and like binge watching The Wire or Stranger Things or something, and you've got your phone out and you're looking at the news. That's the reality that they're adapting to, which is that news isn't your primary screen. It's your secondary screen. And I think it's a really smart strategy, and I think it's going to work. And at least the people at CNN, it's being run by really smart people. One of our closest supporters actually just got a show on CNN Plus, and I think it's great. I think it's going to be good for journalism. It'll probably be good for their revenue model. And hopefully it'll give younger audiences more reason to start learning about the world, which is the biggest benefit, I think, of all of this.
So for this last section, I want to discuss this part, which is, how does one learn about the world in a non-negative fashion? Right? Because there's different critiques of the media you could make. So if this were the 70s or the 80s, and we were talking about how the news is negative, what we'd probably mean when we were making that argument is that you turn on local news at 6 and it's talking about a carjacking and it's talking about a road rage. It's that very specific image, right? So not only are you saying that the news is like negative and bad, but you're also basically implicitly arguing that it's sensationalistic and it's not great. Like, this is why, once again, I was like literally one when this happened, but this is why the whole thing is, wow, America like was transfixed by OJ getting chased in the Ford Bronco for hours and hours and hours, and no one's learning about what's happening in Somalia. Like, that was the implicit critique. But today, once again, going back to Ukraine for a second, that's a case where things are very negative, but it also really matters. So like, what does, do you know what I mean? So when you're saying like people want to learn about the world, like how do you balance that basically? How do you be positive and also, you know, substantive?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it deals with something bigger. I'll reveal something that I haven't really told anybody about. Before the pandemic, Fox News wanted to meet me, a brown Canadian guy named Mohammed who spent his time overseas, because they wanted to know if I'd be interested in being a senior correspondent for them. It caught me totally off guard. This is not the network that has a brown guy named Mohammed as one of their top correspondents. But we're sitting in this meeting, and they taught me something really valuable, and I'm grateful for it. I knew I wasn't going to work for them. like I've made that decision before I went in.
But you take meetings. That's how this business, for people who don't work, you take meetings.
I mean, it's the same thing with investors, right? That like, look, yeah. You know, you're not taking some investor's money, but you want to be polite with everybody. And so you'll meet with them. And believe me, I met a couple of those where I was like, I knew within 10 seconds, I'm not taking this guy's money or this firm's money, but you meet with them because maybe they'll surprise you. So we were talking and they said, well, where do you get your news from? And I went back and I said, well, mostly I get my news from Twitter, which is still true to this day with a little bit of Google News mix in. And he said, so who do you follow on Twitter? And it was the first time in my life that I realized that I was following like Associated Press, Reuters, places that were down the middle. But I was also following CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, mm-hmm. places that would be considered slightly more on the left. And so they stopped me when I started naming out these places. And he said, well, who do you follow on the right? It was the first time in my life that I realized, you know, I actually don't, right? Like I wasn't following Fox News. I wasn't reading what they were saying. I wasn't following like One American News or like any of those other places, right? And that was a problem. It was a problem because I'd realized that like I'd unintentionally exposed myself to only one worldview. Now, I don't agree with a lot of principles on both the left and the right. But my news consumption was skewed towards one perspective. And so I went home from that meeting and I started following some like right-wing accounts, not because I agree with them, but I think it's important to understand that perspective. And I think that broader lesson is applicable to just news consumption in general, that unfortunately, the way revenue models are built today, they reward creating echo chambers, right? So New York Times, something like it's great journalism, but more than 90%, I think it's like 95 or 96% of all New York Times readers self-identify as progressive or towards the left. And what that means is that because of that, and because New York Times has a subscription model, they're incentivized to keep those readers on the payroll or on their subscription roll, which means you've got to have a certain perspective when you report the news. And that's how revenue models are built. For me, I sat back and I said, well, you know, the solution to that is actually pull news from multiple sources. And it's here's the hard part. It's really hard and time consuming to do that because you don't have time to read three articles. You just want to read one. Mm-hmm. You don't have time to watch three stories. You want to just watch one. And unfortunately, it's really hard to find like sort of one source that's going to give you things from both sides, right? You got to know what the bias is, and then you got to get extra information. The short answer is read as much as you can from as many people as you can. And unfortunately, it's not an easy thing for most people to do.
And for the last big question, and I'm asking this as a podcaster, so I think about this question a lot. We're in an incredibly diverse era when it comes to actual venues for gaining news. So it could be your daily podcast, it can be YouTube, it could be Snapchat, it could be TikTok, newsletter, Twitter, whatever. What have you all found is the best format for improving one's mental health? Is it listening to Michael Barbaro? Let's just take the Michael Barbaro, the daily voice. Is it Michael Barbaro speaking nicely into your ear in a daily relationship style thing? Is it reading something that's calming? What have you all found when it comes to content style?
You know, can I answer that from just a very personal perspective and not of like the founder or the CEO of this company? Strangely enough, audio has a way to create a sense of intimacy that doesn't exist on other platforms, mm-hmm. right? So like, you know, if you, they say the proof of this is like, if you go to like a basketball game, right? So you go to like, you know, a Knicks game or a Warriors game or something, and you're wearing, what do you call them? Earplugs. So you can't hear anything. You'll actually see more of the game. You'll see the fouls. Mm-hmm. You'll see Steph Curry do a little shimmy, right? You'll see that. And audio is this really interesting thing because you're not actually seeing anything. So if you're listening to a podcast like yours, for example, or you're listening to an audio space on Twitter, you're not seeing anything and your ears are picking up more information as a result of that. Audio has this great way of just pulling people in. It's slower. It allows for more nuance. It tends to be, the retention span on audio tends to be longer than like video. So like you might only be able to watch 20 seconds of a CNN video. You could probably listen to like a couple of minutes of somebody talking if they have a soothing voice. So I think in terms of like that intimacy, audio is really unique. And if it's the right voice, if it's the right tone, if it's the right delivery, it can be a very calming experience.
Yeah. And I just want to close with this. Like, obviously this is an OnDeck podcast. So we have founders who, like, on a very basic level are looking to have their own mental health story. But, like, you know, you went through the OnDeck experience yourself. So I would just love for you to just do a quick, you know, honest shout off, like what the experience was like for you and any suggestions for whether or not this would be a good fit for folks who are looking at startups in those spaces.
I've been looking forward to answering this question since I knew that you wanted to be on this podcast. I came into OnDeck with no idea how to build a company, no idea how to hire people, no idea how to raise money, and no idea of all the things that I had no idea about, quite frankly. There's a whole bunch of things that I had no clue about. All I knew was that I was onto something that is going to change the world. I went in with a very basic premise. I went in with no expectations. And I said that anytime anybody asks me for help, I'm going to help them. And let's see what happens. I left OnDeck with the biggest pre-seed round ever raised in Canada. We oversubscribed by a massive percent. I left with celebrity investors. I left with amazing investors who run really big syndicates. I left now, we at one point we were up to a team of like 14 staff. When I started OnDeck, it was nobody, it was just me. I left with a state-of-the-art machine learning model that was advised in certain aspects of the build from people at OnDeck. And I left with a CTO, by the way, who was from my OnDeck cohort, which came as a big surprise. We met, we hit it off. I didn't know that I was going to hire her. A year later, she pinged me and she said, "Hey, listen, I just left my job. My startup, you know, I'm winding it down. I love what you're doing." And I said, "I want to hire you." And we hired her very quickly because of the validation of knowing that she was part of OnDeck. It's like, you don't have to go through an HR interview process. If she made it into OnDeck, you kind of know what you're getting. And I would not be where we are today without OnDeck. Quite frankly, it had completely changed the trajectory of this business. And I'll take it a step further and I'll say we're currently raising our seed round and we wouldn't be able to do it without the connections that OnDeck has given us.
And just one quick follow-up on this, because I really identify with your story of having like this kernel of something, but needing the solidifying process. Like, what was the state of Goodable or even just your idea before you actually came to OnDeck?
It was me pushing out good stories on social media with a reach of something like 3 to 4 million per month, which is still really good, by the way.
Yeah.
Not sure about what a Goodable platform would look like. I had all sorts of ideas, but at the time it was basically just me on social media proving a point. And that was the state of Goodable. And if you look at it, so, you know, my cohort ended maybe, I don't know, a year ago. Yeah, actually around a year ago, I think, to this day. And so what does that mean? It means after my cohort ended, within a year, we'd raised a big round. We have investors calling us. We're raising another round. Everything that you see behind me, I know your listeners can't see this, but if they're watching, it's like I'm in a state-of-the-art historic studio in Toronto. This is where we are now after like a year of quote-unquote graduating from our fellowship at OnDeck. So the transformation has been massive. The confidence that it gives you is just insane. And I would listen, man, if people are out there wondering if OnDeck is going to make a difference, I tell people that OnDeck is what Y Combinator used to be 10 years ago, right? And I don't mean that as a negative to Y Combinator. What I mean is that there's a real community at OnDeck of people that you can ask for help and support. And they'll just like jump on a Zoom call with you and be like, "Yeah, here's half an hour of my time. Let's talk." And I don't think I don't want to call it an accelerator because OnDeck is more than just an accelerator, but like other places that you go, you're not going to get that sense of community. You're not going to get that sense of helpfulness where like, if I get a message from somebody at OnDeck, I'll drop what I'm doing to help them. And listen, man, if you're a founder and you're hustling and you're struggling, like how you can't put a value on that.
Yeah.
Right.
No, this is Mohammed. This has been great. Would love for you just to shout out, the website, shout out the app, anything that listeners who are really excited by this should take away from.
Yeah. So you can find the Goodable app, which was just released on both the Apple and Google app stores. It's just Goodable. Search it. You can find us on social media. On Twitter, we're Goodable. On Instagram, we're Goodable News. You can find our website, goodable.co. If you're an investor and you want to reach out to me, just send me a DM on Twitter. I've actually had investors like write us checks just by reaching out on Twitter, which is really nice. And just wish us good, man. Like, listen, if people don't want to follow us, that's fine. If they're tired of news, that's fine. We are saving people's lives, which sounds crazy, but we know that because people have told us. We've gotten notes from people saying, look, you don't know this, but you saved my life. I was going to jump off a bridge today because my country's going to hell and I just lost my job and I don't have no money. And before I was going to jump off, I don't know how, but Goodable showed up on my phone somehow. And it made me cry when I was watching your story. And now every morning I wake up and the first thing I do is I check Goodable. That's our mission. And I don't care about valuations and money and investors and all that stuff. That's great. What I care more about is that there are five people that have reached out to us and said we've saved their life. And that's what I'm going to take with me when I die. I'm going to say, look, I might not have done a lot of good in my life, but I saved five people. And my hope is that if we continue to grow, that'll eventually be 5,000 people. And then even more than that.
Excellent place to end. Mohammed, thank you for joining us on The Deep End.
Thanks so much, Marshall.
Thanks for joining us in The Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.